Welcome to Waiting For You, the podcast where we talk infertility, hope, loss and courage. I'm Janine, mum of one, a newborn and family photographer and lover of dark chocolate. Here we will share stories of families who have faced a different or difficult journey through conception, pregnancy or postpartum. I want to honour these stories and have them be heard, and I want to bring it all, the tears, the hope, the despair and the joy. Today, in my very first interview on this podcast, I am talking to the wonderful Em. Em shares with us the journey to have her son Dylan. She talks us through her experience of endometriosis, IVF, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, and the loss of her beloved Nan in the middle of it all. Thank you so much for sharing with us today, Em. Here's Em's story. Thank you so much for joining me on my first ever interview on my podcast. I'd love you to tell me a little bit about you and your family.
Well, it's an honour to be your first guest. It's kind of scary, actually. So I am a nurse. I've been nursing for 6 years now. My husband is a sales manager for a satellite company, so he travels quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And then we have a lovely two-year-old boy, a two-and-a-half-year-old, because he likes to now remind me of that, and two rescue dogs. And we're really lucky. Wow. We just live around the corner from my mum.
Oh, amazing. I don't think I realised your dogs were rescue dogs. That's pretty cool.
They're pretty special.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Dogs are really special, eh? Can you tell us what you the three of you like to do as a family?
We are big adventurers. Some people call us bonkers, but when Dylan was 4 months old, we took him down to Queenstown for a week in the middle of winter. Yeah. And then when he was 6 months old, I took him around the world to see my family back in the UK, and we stayed there for 8 weeks.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and the plan prior to COVID was to take him to Tokyo just before he turned two and spend 2 weeks over there. But the joys of a global pandemic, we've had to stick a little bit closer to home.
Yeah, and I think you might have told me that you considered taking him to China when he was a newborn. Is that true?
Yeah, so my mum's best friend turned 60 and we were just about to book flights to Hong Kong to spend time with her in Hong Kong and then travel to the Great Wall. But we then got a positive test and decided it's probably not a great idea when he's 3.5 weeks old to pop him on a plane to the other side of the world. That might be a little bit too crazy.
Well, I think the term adventurous really does fit you and your family, Em.
just a bit.
Yeah. Let's get on to your story. So what I'd love you to do is tell us what led you to knowing you were going to need fertility treatment to have a family.
Yeah. So I had painful periods from basically day dot. I was hospitalized for multiple pain. So for about 8 years, I battled to get a diagnosis. I finally convinced my GP that I believed that it was endometriosis. So right. She referred me on to a specialist who's now retired. And after a 5-minute consultation with him, he basically said, look, I can't diagnose it without doing a laparoscopy. Mm-hmm. But all your signs and symptoms are textbook endometriosis.
Right. And can I just jump in and ask, when you say you battled to get a diagnosis, does that mean that people weren't really believing you or didn't really know what it was?
Pretty much. I guess we all kind of grew up in the age and stage where women were told that your period was meant to be painful. Mm-hmm. It was just part of life, you know, Eve's curse and the like. I don't think they realised that it would leave me bedbound for 4 or 5 days, unable mm-hmm. to get out of bed because the pain was so horrific.
Yeah.
And they just thought I was being overly dramatic, despite the fact that all my blood results were coming back anemic and all of that.
Yeah. 8 years is a really long time.
Yeah. I think the average time period is about 8 to 10 years to be diagnosed with endo.
Wow. Yeah. So I was diagnosed as well, but I had all that pain as well, not as bad as what yours sounds, but I didn't realize that that was a problem. It wasn't until we were having fertility troubles that that piece of the puzzle kind of fell into place. But wow, to battle for so long, that's horrible. So you went ahead and had the laparoscopy?
Yep, I had the laparoscopy. They found not super significant. I think he graded it about a 2 or 3. So there's 4 stages of endometriosis. I was graded between a 2 and a 3. But they're always quick to say you're grading. So 4 is severe, but people can have severe endometriosis and cope fine, whereas someone else can have grade 1 and be absolutely in agony.
Yeah, so I have heard that too.
The grading doesn't kind of correlate to the pain that you can suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So had that surgery, and to be honest, I'd been with my now husband for all of 3 months while he had to sit and support me through that.
He's your husband now, so obviously worked out okay.
Yeah, he went well. He coped. Saw me at my worst and thought, oh, she's not that bad.
She's all right, yeah.
Once we kind of got on top of the endo, we got married and then thought, okay, well, now's good time to start thinking about kids. And we tried for 8 or 9 months with no success. And
yeah,
it was getting really painful. I was ending up back in hospital with endo pain every time you get your period. So, you're not pregnant. So that's a real downheartener. And then ending up in hospital needing IV medication to kind of control it.
Right. So did the laparoscopy not reduce your pain in any way?
So after I had the laparoscopy, during the same surgery, they put in a marina, which kept my pain at bay for a few years. But obviously you can't get pregnant with a marina in.
No, right.
So we got that removed not long after we were married.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you know the link between endo and fertility at that time?
I kind of did, but didn't realize how much of a link. I was like, oh, you know, the people that I know that have got endo have also got PCOS and other hormonal issues. And they're the ones that are struggling to have babies and stuff. I never once thought it would be me.
Right.
Looking back, I should have realized the females in my family struggle to have babies. My mum lost a few, and so did my grandma. And prior to my grandma, my great-mother, great-grandmother actually adopted because she couldn't get pregnant. And then I think a couple of months after she adopted, she actually fell pregnant. So there's 11 months between my nana and my great-uncle.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you removed your marina, tried naturally, and things weren't happening. So what happened from there?
So friends of mine were struggling to conceive. So they sought an appointment with Fertility Associates, and it kind of spurred me to do the same.
Right.
So we did that and saw the lovely doctor who wanted to trial me on letrozole, kind of encourage more follicles to be released when you ovulate.
Mm-hmm.
But he also wanted to do an HSG scan, I think that's what it's called, which checks the patency of your fallopian tubes.
So what is patency in relation to a fallopian tube?
So checking to see if it's blocked, making sure that the egg can obviously make it down to your uterus to meet the sperm and things like that.
Okay.
So he offered to do my referral publicly and explain that there'd be a wait, or if I had private health insurance, that would be covered under that. We decided that we'd just go down the private route because, heck, we really didn't want to wait much longer because of the pain I was suffering.
Yeah, exactly. So how did you, at this stage, did you kind of have any inkling that it was going to move into more full-on IV treatment like IVF, or were you just going along? Yeah, you didn't realize at that point. Okay.
No. And so I had my scan. I was taking my best friend back to the airport so she could continue her OE.
Yeah.
And so I had my scan. She's waiting out in the waiting room, and I get told the dreadful news that both my tubes are blocked.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I didn't have my husband with me. My best friend was getting on a plane and leaving, and I've been told this news, and yeah, it broke me.
Yeah, I bet it did. Oh, that's so hard. Wow.
I'll also say at this time I was 23 or 24. Not something you expect to be told.
No.
At that age. Not that you expect it at any age, but it was an absolute gut kick.
Yeah, that is. And was it at that point you kind of were like, oh, this is serious. We're going to be doing something more serious now.
Yeah. And yeah, it sounds dreadful, but as a woman, kind of our job is to reproduce. It's what any creature on earth is meant to do.
Yeah.
And all those emotions hit me going, okay, well, I'm broken. And I think anyone who's been through a battle of infertility knows those feels. It's not something that is isolated to me. Every woman who's been down this road knows those feelings.
Absolutely.
So you're not alone.
Yeah.
And it needs to be talked about, which is why your podcast is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for saying that, because it's so true. People are not alone, but it feels like it when you're in it, right? It's so isolating in so many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that. So how did you, we're going to head into your story of how treatment started for you after finding that out. But can I just ask you might have already answered it actually, but how did you feel about the thought of needing to start more invasive treatment?
I figured that if I wanted, this was the road I was going to have to take. My mum works in family law, so I kind of knew a bit of the ins and outs in regards to adoption, and knew that the numbers weren't great in regards to adopting in New Zealand. So to have a family of our own, IVF was kind of going to be our only option.
Yeah. It's kind of a catch-22, eh? It's like an amazing opportunity in scientific. It's a wonder, but it's also really hard to take. So it's a tricky one. Yeah. Okay. So you said goodbye to your friend. That must have been hard.
Yeah. And then it wasn't easy.
And then did you go kind of, can you talk us through how treatment started for you, and if you went into it straight away, what was the pathway from there?
So followed up with my fertility doctor, who said, well, we can stick you on the public waiting list. But at that time, it was about an 18 to 24 month wait from being on the start of the wait list to actually getting your number called and saying, hey, you can start meds. So we had to go home and figure out if there was any way that we could self-fund a treatment.
Right.
So we decided to sell some property that I'd bought when I was early 20s to help fund that. But also during that time, I lost my nana.
Right.
Who was absolutely dying to be a great grandmother. She was, from the minute I got married, was like, come on, I want a baby now. Come on, keep going. And I remember after, being told that we would have to go through IVF, she was like, right, when I'm better, you need to take me down to the wool shop. I'm going to buy some wool. And I didn't know at the time that she'd wanted to make me, my future baby, a knitted shawl like she'd made me and my sister.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't even cross my mind. And I was like, yeah, all right, I'll take you when you're better. Unfortunately, that didn't come.
She didn't get better.
No, on the side, her and my mum were actually trying to talk about how they could work together to kind of fund our treatment if we decided not to sell.
Yeah, amazing.
Again, all that comes out later. They needed the baby as much as we did.
Right. Family seems really important to you. You really are you very really close to your mom and your grandma?
Yeah, and my little sister.
Right.
My mom and my nana are the strongest women I have ever met. So anytime I come across something that I don't think I can tackle, I'm like, okay, well, they've tackled worse. Pick yourself up. You've got this. You can do it.
And so losing Nana at this time, I imagine, felt a double blow.
Yeah, being told that you can't have a baby and then losing one of your biggest supporters wasn't great. But I think we kind of recovered from that and decided, well, it's now or never. So we paid the extravagant bill and started IVF. It was not great handing over that amount of cash just to get a baby.
Well, there's no guarantee.
There's no guarantee.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like a lottery, not a lottery, but it feels once you've been in that world, you realise that it is a bit like that. Hey, you just might be flushing it down the toilet, basically.
And I think that's where both Alistair, my husband, and I were kind of like, okay, this is a lot of money and we may not get anything back from it.
Yeah. So, Em, can you talk us through your IVF cycle, what that was like for you?
So I waited for my menstrual cycle to start, and then you call them on day three to go in. Or day three, day one. Day one when it first starts.
Yes, day one, yeah.
And you go in and collect your meds in your little green coolie bag.
You do, yes.
Everybody who's been through Fertility Associates knows that green coolie bag and knows it very well. It's a love-hate relationship.
Yes.
So I did that, and then I can't remember my exact cycle, but I think I started the injections on day three.
Right.
Does that sound about right? I started the injections, and no one at work apart from my charge nurse knew that I was going through IVF, so I would have to – I was working shift work at the time.
Yeah.
So I would have to keep my green coolie bag in my locker and hope that no one went into my locker because I didn't have a lock on it at the time.
Yeah.
And sneak in between patients in the evenings to do my jabs.
Wow.
Get my sharps into a sharps bin.
Yes.
At work.
Wow.
So that was a big thing, especially when you start to get bloating from the follicles and the meds, and you just feel pretty grotty trying to work through it all. And then I remember going for the scans at silly o'clock in the morning to try and beat traffic and then actually get back to work.
Yeah.
And it's quite invasive when they do the scans. I didn't – again, even though I'd been through endometriosis and had internal scans before, I wasn't expecting it to kind of be the same with IVF. I think I went into it a bit, just a bit naive, I think is probably the best term.
Yeah, I don't think I realised that either. They are quite invasive, aren't they?
And you have to do it every couple of days to check the follicles and then go for blood tests and then of course, one of my days fell on a Sunday, so we had to drive all the way from West Auckland to near Sylvia Park, which is 45 minutes away, to get my bloods done on a Sunday because they were the only lab test that was open.
I've done that one too.
And again, you're not the only one sitting there with your bright yellow form. There's a whole bunch of other women. So again, you feel kind of part of the silent community. You all know why each other's there, but no one wants to say anything because no one wants to jinx it. You get really superstitious.
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
I found myself, you know, I'd go for the scans and get told how many follicles they could see, and I'd get not obsessive about the numbers, but go, okay, well, I've got this. How many of them are actually going to have eggs in them, or things like that?
I think it's really easy to become obsessive when you're doing a cycle of IVF. It's a strange thing, but it really kind of overtakes your life for the time that you're doing that cycle. I found myself.
Yeah, totally.
It's like you're all in and you can't really think about anything else.
No, especially when you've had to fund, well, I think even if you haven't had to fund it, you want to have a baby so bad.
Yeah.
And you want it to work. And yeah. There's not much, there's nothing you can do to control it other than do your jabs at the right time or take medication.
Right.
You just have to kind of ride the roller coaster.
You do. Yeah, absolutely.
And
you
hope
do.
That it's a good ending.
Yeah, so. That's true. And so how is, do you want to tell us about what egg collection was like for you and explain what that procedure's like?
Yeah. So for me, I seem to be quite sensitive to medication.
Okay.
And no one kind of realized this. My bloods hadn't shown it, but I was actually getting ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. And when we went into egg collection, I was bloated, I was sore, and the medication that they gave me didn't put me into a twilight sedation or anything like that. I could feel it.
Really?
They had to give me more. So I remember all of about 2 or 3 minutes of it, and then I remember absolutely nothing because they must have maxed out what they could give me.
Wow.
But Alistair was in the room, and he's seen me in a lot of pain before, but not like this. So he was kind of like, come on, you've got to give her something, you know. He felt absolutely helpless because, again, he had watched me give my jabs for the last, close to 14, 15, 16 days. And there was nothing he could do for it. I know some people's partners give them the jabs, but, again, I was a nurse, or I am a nurse. It made far more sense for me to the control over doing the jabs and make sure that all the medicine got in, because I knew, I think deep down, that if he hadn't done it right, I would have potentially had blame on him. At least I had the control.
I understand that. Yeah.
I needed that at the time. So egg collection wasn't great. It was quite painful. But we got, I believe, 44 eggs. It's a lot higher than anyone was anticipating. They just kept coming. I think Fertility Associates at that time had only had one person get more eggs.
Really?
She sat at about 63.
Oh, wow. And can we just go back to, can you just explain, or maybe this will be the next part of what you tell us about what ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome is, and does that relate to how many eggs you had in there?
I don't believe it affects how many eggs that you get. But it just means that your ovaries go into kind of like hyperdrive and can create more and more follicles. It doesn't mean, and they, when they saw how many follicles I had, I do remember this from the collection, they're like, well, we don't expect to find an egg in every sac.
Okay.
But they did.
But they kind of did. Yeah. And what does ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome mean for you when you've got it?
So when you've got it, they can give you medication to kind of down-regulate your hormones, and you take that for about a week afterwards, and most people have no complications. I ended up, because they had to extract as many eggs as they did and try and drain the follicles, I ended up with a massive pelvic bleed.
Right, and wow.
I went into urinary retention. So it meant that I couldn't pass urine or anything like that because of the pain and swelling in my uterus and my abdomen. So I spent 4 days in hospital afterwards having regular scans to make sure that my ovaries were reducing in size and that the fluid and stuff in my abdomen was draining.
Wow.
So I needed to be monitored. And I can look back on it now and kind of laugh and go, okay, this is absolutely textbook M. Everything through my life I don't do by halves. And, of course, my IVF journey was going to be the same. I'm an overachiever, and I definitely did.
I love that. Right. So you got better from that, finally?
I did get better from that.
So tell me about those days that follow egg collection and with the embryologist calling or nurse calling you afterwards.
So they ring you on day one to tell you how many fertilized.
Yeah.
And then they ring you again on day three. And then they ring you again on day five. And day five, like in my case, I had, I think, 36 eggs fertilized to become embryos.
Yeah.
I think that dropped to about 30 on day three. Mm-hmm. And because I had hyperstimulated, I had no chance of doing a fresh transfer.
Oh, I see. Okay. So that has to all get frozen.
Yep. So all I had to do a freeze all cycle. So all those 30 on day three I knew weren't going back inside me. I would have to wait easily another month to kind of let the fertility drugs go out of my system and try and reset. Right. And then on day five, I got a phone call and I was out shopping by myself and I kind of had forgotten about the phone call, trying to just distract myself.
Yes.
And I was waiting in line to pay for something somewhere and I get the phone call and I'm like, oh, right, okay, great. Thinking from everything that I'd read in the Facebook groups, okay, day three to day five, you can lose easily half to three quarters of your eggs. And then when she rang and she said, we have 22 embryos that we're about to put in the freezer for you, I was ecstatic.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, well, 22, that's a lot of options. And she said, and we've got five or six that we're still waiting. We're going to give one more day just to see if they hatch. So I get a call the next day and she's like, yep, you've now got 27 embryos on ice. And here's me thinking, I love sport, but I'm not having a rugby pitch. Like, I'm not having a family that would be able to take to the rugby pitch with reserves.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
You know, that was my immediate thought. It was quite scary, especially when you see some people's numbers, they get like six eggs and then only half of those fertilize and then they're left with one on day three.
That was me. That was exactly me. Yeah.
Yeah. So here I was thinking, oh my gosh, I've now got this. But what if none of them are viable? What if they've made it this far, but none of them take?
Right. And there's never any guarantees on any of it, any step in the process.
No.
So it was a lot, but you still didn't know how that was going to look. And also some of them don't even survive the thawing process, do they?
No, they don't. That's the other risk. You're like, okay, well, I've now got these, but now they have to survive and you have to hope that the embryologist who's on that day is taking great care with your potential baby.
Yeah.
And again, it's, you don't have any control. Once you've done your injections, you have no control over the rest of the process.
Yeah.
It's kind of all up to somebody else. I mean, I know that getting pregnant naturally is, you know, something like 20% a month you have chance of getting that right time period.
Yes.
And you don't have control over that, but at least it's kind of up to you and your partner. You can kind of, sounds awful, but go hammer and tongs for those 48 hours and hope for the best.
Yeah.
But when you do IVF, you have no control.
Yeah, that's so true. And so did that lack of control and any other things around doing this whole process, how did that affect you emotionally, mentally? Were you okay or did you find it really challenging?
I think I found it pretty challenging because during the process, a lot of friends got pregnant. And some people were nervous to tell me or they didn't tell me at all. And I found out through Facebook or through other friends. And I was sad for Alistair and I, but because we were doing IVF, I knew what a miracle it was. And I was so ecstatic for these friends. Aww. I was like, you're getting what you wanted. It's amazing. It's a miracle. Please let me share this joy. Yes, it slightly hurts me, but I'm more happy for you because you get to extend your family. You know, you get to have that unconditional love that you have for children.
Oh, you've got such a big heart, Em, because that's hard. That's hard to be able to see, you know, kind of see outside of yourself and enjoy what other people are getting. Yeah.
I think, though, that's the thing. Everyone has a different journey. I'm such a firm believer that everyone has their own path and everything happens for a reason and you might not be able to see it at the time, but it's there to teach you something or you're meant to gain something from it. Like my IVF journey, I've made so many friends. I've made friends with you, and the community of IVF ladies is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, once you find those groups, you don't feel so alone.
That is so true. Yeah. Because when we did treatment, we were pre-Facebook, because I'm so old, but or at least I wasn't on Facebook then. And so I knew no one until someone introduced me to a friend of theirs, and that was like gold to me, just knowing someone else who'd done this. Yeah, so all those groups and stuff, I imagine, are really helpful for people.
They are, and I think it's something that's still not talked about enough, is that a lot of people nowadays are having to use assistance to get pregnant.
Yeah,
and
so
it's not
many.
Anything to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my journey. I've realized that there's nothing that I could have done about it. It was just the way my body was made, and it was my journey. And, you know, it's there was nothing that I could have done to change it. And that's what I had to kind of process through the situation. It's okay, I have endo, but me running 6 days a week, eating no junk food, no concentrated food, nothing like that was going to change my outcome.
Yeah.
But it's a process.
Yeah.
There's a grief. There's a grief that you can't do it naturally.
Yeah. There really is a grief process in all of this. I agree completely. Yeah. So can we move on to when you had the transfer? So when you, the time passed that you were able to take an embryo and pop it back in?
Yep. So we had a false start. I got my period, and then they make you wait, and then they measure your lining. And then 2 days before I was meant to do the transfer, I got another period. So all my lining that was at a beautiful 17 mils was gone.
Wow.
And my doctor had never seen that either.
You're a medical mystery.
Yeah, I totally was. He's like, this is strange, but okay, we'll wait a little bit longer. And so Easter weekend comes along and we're ready. And I said to Alistair, don't worry about it. He had a really important meeting and he's like, I'll change it. We're doing a transfer. I was like, ugh. You know, seeing everything from everybody else going, oh, well, the first transfer doesn't work. Don't move your meeting. It's really important that you go. In my head, I was like, oh, if he doesn't get a meeting, he might lose his job. We'll get a black mark. And I was like, I can't deal with that at the moment.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My mum came with me.
Right.
My dog decided to jump all over mum that morning when she came to pick me up and tripped her over. And mum was in a lot of pain, but mum didn't tell me. So we go all the way out to Green Lane. We do the transfer, and that was pretty awesome. And they just had the radio on in the background.
Yeah.
And Robbie Williams' Angels was on the radio. And my mum and I are huge, huge fans of Robbie Williams. He was the first concert I ever went to at six or – no, I must have been older than that. I must have been about 9 years old, and mum took me out to watch him at Mount Smart. And my sister would have only been 8 or 9 weeks at the time.
Wow.
So mum left her at home with my dad and took me out to this concert. So that was pretty cool. And then to have, obviously, my dad's no longer with us. And obviously, my nana passing just before we started our IVF journey. That was pretty emotional and special, having that come on the radio.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so we get home. Mum then goes to A&E and finds out that she's actually broken two toes.
Oh, no.
And she only tells me that later. And I'm dealing with the two-week wait. And I don't feel pregnant in that 2 weeks. I'm like, well, it's not worked. There's not even implantation bleeding. So obviously, you'd rather get a show to say that it's implanted or you get nothing. And I'm like, well, there's nothing there. It's not worked.
Yeah.
And so 2 weeks comes along and my mum's actually selling her house and we're having a house leaving party because it's the house that my sister grew up in. So we go there and it's on that day that I'm actually Friday the 13th, which is unlucky for some. It wasn't for me. I get the phone call at 2 o'clock in the evening because, again, most people here in the morning and I'm like, well, I've not heard from them, so they must be telling the good news in the morning to all the people that have successfully pregnant.
Wait until the afternoon.
They're leaving me until the afternoon, and my husband's messaging me, have you heard? And my mum's messaging me, have you heard? And I'm just ignoring them because I hadn't heard anything. And I was like, there's no point. And so my husband's then ringing my mum going, oh, it must be bad news. Emma's not heard. I've not heard anything from Em. You know, what's going on? And I was like, just leave it. And then I get the phone call. And I won't lie, when the nurse told me, I swore down the phone and then promptly apologized because I didn't believe it had happened. I didn't believe I was ever going to be lucky enough to have it go first time. And I know the stats were not in my favor.
Yeah.
I'm so
grateful
that they were. Everything must, all my ducks must have been in a row. It must have just been my time.
It was your time. Aww.
So. Yeah, I got told that I was pregnant, and I think at that point you're considered like 10 days pregnant four weeks pregnant. You're only technically 10 days, but they're like, yep, so you're 4 weeks and these are your
levels.
They
do.
We expect them to rise, and you need to do your blood tests every 2 days to make sure that they're rising. Mm-hmm. So that, although you get this amazing good news, you've then got to keep going with these blood tests to make sure that your HCG levels are rising and doubling or tripling every 24 hours or 48 hours.
Yeah.
So then you've got that stress and you're like,
You continue to get the phone calls. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't stop, does it?
It doesn't stop. And then they bombard you and you do your 7 week scan when you – you know, if you've been lucky enough to get that part where they look and see if there's a heartbeat, and yet your own heart's in your mouth going, oh, please let there be a heartbeat, you know, and there was, and they're like, that's great, we're discharging you. And I think I was in a bit of denial because I didn't organise a midwife.
Right.
And I was due at Christmas time.
Wow. Oh.
So I hadn't decided if I was going to go with an obstetrician or a midwife. And being due at Christmas, midwives are a bit scarce on the ground.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Also, most people, and unbeknownst to me, as soon as they get a positive pregnancy test, call a midwife and book in because they can always be discharged if it doesn't go to plan. I didn't know this. I had no idea. No one had ever told me. Fertility associates definitely hadn't. So I was in a state of denial. So I rang a few midwives and I still wasn't sure if I wanted to go down that type of pathway for care or with the OBG.
Yeah.
And I think I was actually more leaning towards the OBG from a science medical point of view, going, you know what, they're a doctor, they're going to scan me every time they see me rather than just do the Doppler.
Yeah.
The price was a bit off-putting.
But
I had to put it, and I explained it to Alistair. I was like, I need that peace of mind. I need to be able to know that every 4 weeks I'm going to see my baby growing and that I'm going to have a doctor on hand. Heaven forbid something was to happen.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know that I was going to be seeing. So where I went had a team of five OBGs and you kind of saw them at different times. But you got to know them all. So one of them at the end of the day would deliver your baby.
Right,
And I think I just needed that support. And everyone's different. I didn't know any midwives, so it made sense to kind of just follow the medical route. And I was like, we've done IVF. It's purely medical. Let's just keep going.
And so do you want to tell us what Dylan's birth was like?
So I got induced on the 15th of December.
Yep.
And the first induction didn't work, so they let me go overnight. Alistair went home, and then we tried again the next day, and that didn't work. So we tried on the third day, and I think I've got my dates wrong, but either way.
Yeah,
I had
a few days before.
Inductions. Then on the 18th, they manually broke my waters, and by 11 o'clock, I was having regular contractions and was put on Syntocin.
Yep.
And then come 8 o'clock that night, I still hadn't dilated enough. I was still only three centimetres dilated.
Mm-hmm.
He'd had no fluid. I was on monitoring, and my OBG came in and was like, you've not progressed enough. He's okay at the moment. We can give you a little bit longer, but I believe this is going to end up in a C-section. And to be honest, I was completely okay with that. I think in my head I was tired. Pregnancy had been long and arduous, and I was just ready to meet my baby. And I'm like, you know what, if this is how he's going to be safe and I'm going to be safe and I get to meet him, that's how my birth story is going to go. I went into my birth not having a plan. The only plan was that I was going to be okay and that B3, as we called him throughout my pregnancy, was going to be okay. That was it. That was my only plan.
I love that. I love that kind of story of acceptance around a C-section, because often I think it can be that people are so disappointed or feel like some kind of failure or whatever. But that's so nice to hear the way you've described that.
Yeah, I went into it calm and was like, that is what it is.
Yeah, amazing. And so he was born, and how did it feel to hold him in your arms for the first time?
When I eventually got to recovery and got to hold him, it was fantastic. Alistair got to do the first hold and he loved it. He was crying. I've only ever really seen him cry at my wedding when I got married to him and I walked down the aisle and he was doing his vows. Yeah. And when he held Dylan for the first time.
Oh, I've got goosebumps.
No, it was amazing. And when I finally got to hold him in recovery, because in recovery you're only meant to have one support person. Alistair had been in the operating room with me and my mum had been at the hospitating.
Right.
I think when we finally got to recovery, it was 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. So she must have been knackered. But the nurses in there let Alistair swap out and my mum come in. So she got to hold him. She was the third person to hold him within, I don't know, he must have been only an hour old.
Yeah.
So that amazing. It was fantastic getting mum to hold my baby that we waited so long for.
Yeah.
The other awesome thing is I come from a generation of all girls. There's me and my sister. I've got three cousins on my mum's side that are all female. In fact, I have a fourth cousin joining that side of the family in October.
Yeah.
And two female cousins on my dad's side. And then to finally have a little boy, it was like the entire generation had waited for. It was
Special guy.
Yeah, he's very special.
He is. Can I ask how you chose his name?
So we, like most people, had a list and there wasn't many that we both agreed on. But I had three names that were top of mind. It was Ryan, Alex, and Dylan.
Yeah.
And all of them have different meanings, but Dylan in French actually means lion or little lion. I come from, such a female strong family. And obviously the women and lionesses are the hunters and the protectors.
Everything.
It made sense that he was just going to be my little lion cub. So that was my favorite name, but I let Alistair pick his name. Alistair knew kind of where my head was, and I hadn't even seen Dylan at this point, and I just said to Alistair, what's his name? He's like, it's Dylan. Because I wanted to see, I wanted to see what he looked like and stuff before we named him.
Yeah.
It was just, it was pretty fantastic. He also shares his middle name with my dad and both my grandfathers and a few other males in my family. His middle name's Charles. It's super traditional, but
it's beautiful. It's
one way of tying in kind of the males in my family, given that Alistair gets to share his surname with Dylan and have that continue.
Yeah. That's such a lovely story. Can I ask what the first few months were like for you as a mum when you took him home?
I think it was, like most mums, a shock to the system. I was really, really lucky that I had such a good support network, not just of like my mum and my sister and my stepdad and all of that, but I have such a good group of friends who have all had kids, and I never once felt judged for the choices that I made in regards to, breastfeeding or bottle feeding. Having to rock into sleep if that's what I had to do. Like I felt so, so supported, and I felt so lucky to have had that support, because I know some women don't, and it's really, really isolating.
Yeah, that's how it should be, right? Raise your baby in a village. That's really beautiful.
And that's kind of what we've always envisioned, is family isn't just those that are blood related. It's the people you choose to have in your life and be there for the big things and the not so great things. So it was really, really awesome to have that. Don't get me wrong, waking up in the middle of the night when your baby's crying is never easy.
No.
Especially when Alistair had to go away a few times during the first kind of 3 months.
Yeah.
For work or other things. But I think all my trials and tribulations to get Dylan, and I always feel awful saying it, meant that I got an angel baby. He's always been a really easy, cruisy kid.
Yeah.
And I always feel really awful saying it because I know so many people have such a tough time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was lucky. He would sleep from midnight to six from a few weeks old. And
wow.
I think we kind of had him sleeping. I had to move him into his own room early because I just couldn't sleep with my little noisy hedgehog right beside my head.
Yes.
And again, I felt awful about it. Everyone was like, no, you need to do it for you guys.
Yeah.
Your sanity is worth everything. So he was sleeping probably from 3 months, sleeping through the night because he was a big boy too. Like he didn't need to wake in the night for feeds.
Right.
That's the thing. It's totally just luck of the draw, and I know that.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
There's nothing that I did that made him like that. He just decided that he needed sleep, so that was fine.
Take the wins, eh?
Exactly. I'm sure I'll make up for it when he's a teenager.
You know? Yeah. No, he'll probably just sleep heaps then too.
Oh, I hope so. I don't need the grey hairs.
No, we don't need that. The next question I've got for you, I ask with trepidation because I know it can be something that you would come across in your life sometimes now, but I have your permission to ask. So it's around whether you feel you and Alistair would like to grow your family, or whether you feel like you're done, or kind of like what are you thinking around that? And I just know that you might have people saying, when are you going to have another baby? And I know that's such a challenging thing to hear.
It's never easy deciding to expand. I'd love another one, but I don't know if as a family we're ready, or if we ever will be. And I think everyone, no one's ever ready for adding an extra person. It's hard.
And it's okay to feel like that and to not be sure. I really do believe that. I have two final questions for you, Em. The first one is, what did you learn about yourself during this process?
That my stubbornness can be an asset, although it annoys everybody how hard I push myself. It really kind of got me through it. Infertility is not something you'd wish on your worst enemy. It's such an awful journey, but I wanted to keep pushing through it, and I got lucky at the end.
You really did. Your little boy is such a sweetie. I like that answer. That's cool. And final question for you, what does it mean to you to be a mother?
Oh, absolutely everything. It's so, so cliche, but he's one of the best things that ever happened to me. I won't say the best because, you know, my husband's pretty great.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have Dylan without him. And
of course,
it means that I've got my best mate with me all the time. Like, he is the cutest kid, and he's the perfect blend of Alistair and I. And, you know, he's just... So he brings me so much joy. So motherhood just means absolutely everything to me.
Oh, that's so special. And is he an adventure? Do you think he's got the adventurer in him too?
Oh, yes. He's he's a daredevil like both my husband and I. And he's showing that all the time, running and jumping off the sofa and having absolutely no fear. So... life's going to be an absolute adventure bringing him everywhere.
Yeah, that's so amazing. Oh, Em, I'm ending this first episode with tears in my eyes listening to you talk about what it means to you to be a mum, because I, I know your journey and I know how hard it is. And so thank you so much for doing this for me and for sharing your story for others to hear, because I'm sure that hearing this will help someone else who's doing it tough right now.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. And for anyone who's out there listening but struggling, ask for help. Don't try and battle through your IVF journey by yourself, because, you know, if you've got that support network, utilize them, because they'll happily take you out for a coffee and distract you, or, you know, do anything that's going to take your mind off that awful 2-week wait, or support you through anything that doesn't kind of go the way we want and isn't positive. Don't isolate yourself. Use the people around you, because they want to be there for you.
Yeah, that's such good advice. It really is. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.
Thank you so much, Em, for sharing your story with us today. Thank you for your openness, your honesty, and your generosity with your story. And as always, I hope this podcast brings you all hope, healing, and hugs. Mm-hmm.